from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
The Russian president personally pinned a friendship medal on Rex Tillerson's chest.
A new humanitarian crisis is unfolding in the Syrian city of Aleppo.
The CIA comes out and produces somebody on the record. You're going to dispute this the entire time.
I just don't know whether it's true or not.
We have a president-elect who has great confidence in his a priori assumptions, mm-hmm. his a priori beliefs, and at least in this case, he's not willing to hear contrary arguments.
For Wisconsin, the president-elect met with Bill Gates, Jim Brown, Ray Lewis, and Kanye West.
That's some of the news I suppose we'll tackle this week in The Wheelhouse. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky. There are not many cars in the parking lot today, so we had extra room for Suzanne's mom, Dan.
Oh, my gosh.
Suzanne Bates is
Sometimes
here.
We have to park it off-site. You know,
Suzanne Bates, who drove in here. She's the policy director
Defender
of the Yankee Institute.
Of minivans everywhere.
Suzanne, good to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Daniela Altamari is here, State House reporter for the Hartford Courant. Hello there, Daniela.
Hi.
So first of all, look, I have to say that we've been trying week in, week out here on The Wheelhouse to refocus ourselves a bit more on state-level issues. And there's a lot that we have to get to at the state coming up in just a bit. But in this time of transition, it seems like there's about 15 stories a day coming out of the new Washington, which is New York, Trump Tower. This week, the big story is this. A CIA report released over the past week has concluded that Russia intervened in the election to help Donald Trump win the presidency. Now, here's President-elect Trump from a Fox News interview this past weekend speaking about whether he believes Russia interfered.
I think it's ridiculous. I think it's just another excuse. I don't believe it. I don't know why. And I think it's just, they talked about all sorts of things. Every week it's another excuse. We had a massive landslide victory, as you know, in the Electoral College. I guess the final numbers are now at 306, and she's down to a very low number. No, I don't believe that at all.
Okay, so here's General Michael Hayden. He's former director of the CIA and the NSA, talking about CIA's claims of Russian attempts to influence the election. Now, he was interviewed on NPR earlier this week.
A president has a right to challenge the CIA. I have experienced that in my time in government. Game on. That's fair. You have to be able to stand your ground. But the challenge is based on your analysis. The challenge is based on your appreciation of the facts. The challenge is based on, I have an alternative reason for this. This is just a dismissal of what the agency has said without an investigation of its data or of its analysis. That's scary that the fact-based guys get shoved out of the room before there is any argument. Frankly, Rachel, it appears because what they're concluding seems unpleasant.
And again, talking to Rachel Martin on NPR. So Michael Hayden Collins says the fact-based guys are once again getting shoved out of the room. But here's before the president-elect even takes office, he's not listening to his CIA telling him, yeah, Russians got involved and they hacked the election.
Well, yeah. I mean, Maleficent didn't like to listen to her mirror either when they told her she wasn't the fairest one of all. So, and it's a little bit like that. I mean, how unattached is Donald Trump to facts? He got 306 electoral votes, but he doesn't know how many electoral votes Hillary Clinton got. The answer is 232 because they have to add up to 538. But I don't know if you noticed, he goes, we got 306 and she got a very low number. It's like he couldn't even memorize those two numbers. He only wanted to memorize the one that was about him. And I mean, that's what this is about, obviously. He's to complain that he's not interested in the details, that he's not interested in the facts, that he's not willing to subject the claim and counterclaim to any kind of rigorous analysis is, it's kind of old news at this point. I do feel like we're at another one of these very unprecedented chapters. Michael Hayden may be correct. Michael Hayden, by the way, not a particularly partisan guy one way or the other, but Hayden might be correct that it has happened in the past that presidents and presidents-elect have faced off with the intelligence establishment over their ideas, but not like this. So, I mean, we have, it would have been weird enough if the CIA said, we now are very comfortable saying that the Russians intentionally interfered in our election. That's a pretty weird thing for them to say. But for them to say they intentionally interfered with our election for the purposes of getting one particular candidate, Donald Trump, elected over Hillary Clinton, I mean, that, you know, if this had been anything like a normal year, that really would have stood out as this incredibly bone-chillingly crazy, alarming thing. But there's just, you know, they flooded the zone with so much craziness that, you know, it's just one more thing.
But and this isn't to defend any of this, but I will say that in our lifetimes we have lived through the CIA being accused of clearly doing this very same thing in other countries, of being involved in operations that we wish they were more transparent about that have negatively affected Americans' lives. And in that same interview that we played a clip from, Michael Hayden said, you know, in probably the biggest decision that the intelligence community made in the last couple decades, when they determined that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, which turned out not to be the case, and sent thousands and thousands of Americans to war, and millions of people end up having their lives changed forever, there is some credence to the notion that just because the CIA says it's true, don't necessarily mean it's true.
Yeah, absolutely. That has been one of Trump's rejoinders. You know, who are you going to believe? You know, I don't know what to say about that. I mean, absolutely, that critique is true. It holds water. I mean, the CIA, A, meddles from time to time in the domestic affairs of other countries, and the CIA, B, has been wrong, glaringly wrong, about a thing or two in the past. I don't know where that ultimately gets you. It's sort of – you go back to what Hayden said. Well, okay, so let's analyze to whatever degree we can these claims. Now, one of the problems with all CIA claims is that they can't tell you everything about how they know what they know without burning sources, without, you know, shutting down the avenues that allowed them to gather this intelligence in the first place. So you do get these kind of solipsistic moments in any conversation with the intelligence establishment. But still, to whatever degree it's possible to put facts on the table and analyze them, let's do that.
Yeah, I think there are probably two issues at play here, right? I mean, one, did the Russians intervene in our election? I mean, it sounds like there are senators, Republican senators, who want to look into this. I think that's good, no matter what President Trump says. I don't think that – I mean, I don't know. We'll see what the investigation says. But I don't think that changed the outcome of the election. I don't think that's why Trump won.
Right.
Now, there's second issue at play here, which is Trump's kind of blind spot on Russia, which he's getting a lot of pushback, I think, across the board. I don't think this is just a single-year issue. I mean – Russia has been a concern, I think, over the past 8 years. I think President Obama, his foreign policy, I haven't been a big fan of his foreign policy. I think he's allowed Russia to really capture power in his region. You know, there's some very disturbing things happening right now in Syria and Aleppo. And, you know, a lot of this has to do with Russia's, you know, involvement in that region, in Syria and Ukraine. And President Obama has been very hands-off in his foreign policy, I would say almost fearful. And I think that has affected Russia's power. And now we have a president, and this is alarming to me, who has a blind spot on Russia. So what is that going to mean for that region? I don't know.
And what are you hearing, Daniela, from the Connecticut political class about this question of Donald Trump's closeness to Russia, and also this question that comes out of the CIA report that doesn't just suggest but from their viewpoint, factually shows that Russia intervened in the election?
Well, I'm not hearing a whole lot from Connecticut folks at this point. I mean, you know, in fairness, I don't think we've asked them about it. But, you know, you had this story in the Times today about Russia's interference, not just in the presidential election, but, you know, this DCCC, this Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee hack, where they were meddling in really low level, you know, congressional races that, you know, weren't really on anyone's radar. And, you know, some of them weren't even all that close or contested. And it just was a fascinating story by former Harvard Current reporter Eric Lipton and others at the Times. Really interesting, you know. So it appears, at least from these stories, that the level of interference runs really, really deeply.
In fact, Daniela, I'd like you to see you go over those Art Linares numbers now and see. The Russians may have been – their tentacles may reach deeper than
that. You never know.
Well, I know I will say in reading the article, it, you know, it continually he comes back to similarities or differences from the Watergate break-in. Mm-hmm. You know, this bungled burglary back in the early 1970s into Democratic headquarters. This was a less bungled burglary of a type. Some of the information, probably not necessarily all that damning, but it adds up to a flood of information the Democrats had to deal with.
Yeah, and there's a question, really, what was the Russians' end game? I mean, okay, if they wanted to elect Trump, that's one thing, you know, to get a friend in the White House. But, you know, a congressional race in Florida or a, you know, uncontested race in New Mexico. And the article mentioned, you know, some speculation. Maybe their goal was just to undermine democracy, that Putin was playing to his hometown, you know, his home audience in Russia to show, you know, democracy is a failure, which is, you know, really fascinating.
We fix you now. We get big, crazy, narcissistic man to be president of your stupid democracy. Then we mess up your Congress.
Well, let's actually turn to some of the other things that came out this week, including, you know, as Suzanne said, this increasing coziness that the incoming Trump administration seems to have with Russia. We've heard an awful lot in the past during the campaign about Connecticut-born Paul Manafort, who is on and off the campaign and his close ties to Ukraine. Now, as Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, President Chief Executive ExxonMobil, certainly a fan, Suzanne, of fossil fuels, certainly a fan of a different type of energy strategy and global strategy than has been, in place over the course of the last 8 years. And again, someone close to Russia.
Yes. And I think that's probably more reflective of Trump's position on Russia than it is, you know, I mean, he's going to choose people who agree with him on a lot of these issues. Now, Rex Tillerson actually has a lot of sort of mainstream Republican support. Condoleezza Rice, Jeb Bush, he was on Jeb Bush's fundraising team. So, you know, I would say he's not that wild a pick to a lot of mainstream Republicans, but definitely I can see, you know, I mean, look, when President Obama picked his cabinet, there was a lot of concern on the right with a lot of the picks. And so I think you're seeing a lot of concern. But I don't think President-elect Trump's picks have been all that radical in terms of where his positions are. They've, you know, they've pretty much fallen in line with what he said on the campaign trail.
Colin?
Well, I mean, I do think that, first of all, what I would say overall about the cabinet picks is that they strongly resemble the campaign. The genius of the campaign was that if you tell one lie and get caught, that's pretty bad. If you tell 50 lies and get caught, after a while, people stop caring. It stops being a big event. You know that if you have like 50 brush fires, it somehow or other looks less, you know, urgent than one big fire. So a lot of these picks are problematic. I mean, look, Tillerson does have backing of establishment, you know, diplomatic people. I think Gates, maybe Jim Baker or Condoleezza Rice, as you said, Suzanne, people like that, you know, I think they even were urging Trump to pick this guy. On the other hand, you know, as is so often the case with a lot of Trump stuff, we are venturing into terra incognita as far as conflict of interest. I mean, we typically don't have secretaries. I'm not saying that Jim Baker or people like that didn't have like business backgrounds and stuff like that, but this is really different, right? You've got a Secretary of State who's coming into this job from an area of business that's materially affected by what goes on all over the globe. You know, that he takes one step out of Exxon and one step into the Secretary of State's office. And so, I mean, we're in a really new place having a guy like that in there.
Well, speaking of a really new place, let's take a flashback quickly to 2011. This is a presidential debate. And here's a former Republican presidential candidate, Rick Perry, talking about some of the departments he'd dismantle if he gets elected.
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
I love oops.
So he's the secretary of oops now.
He's the secretary of oops. Now, Rick Perry, who couldn't remember the name of the energy department, is going to be the secretary of it. Now, I said something similar to this, Colin, last week, and I'll say it again. Yes, we are in uncharted territory. The Rex Tillerson pick sounds like, as Suzanne suggested, the type of person that Donald Trump would, if you take all the things that Donald Trump has said about what he wants to do to heart, he's the type of pick Donald Trump would have. Some of these other picks, like Rick Perry at the head of energy, which he wanted to dismantle, suggests this different style, not too dissimilar from what Daniela was just talking about Vladimir Putin wanting to do to democracy, right? If you want something to fail, you put someone in charge of it who doesn't like the idea that it exists in the first place. It seems as though he's, I don't know, completely changing or trying to subvert the idea of the energy department by putting a Rick Perry in charge of it who doesn't even want to have an energy department exist.
Right. I don't know what Rick Perry is going to do as Secretary of Energy, and it could be that he sees a bigger football field than he did at that particular moment at that particular debate. Sometimes when you're campaigning for a nomination, you say stuff that isn't really part of your core belief system, but you think it's going to sound good, provided you can remember three out of three things. I do think that in general, looking at a lot of these picks, it does seem like there's a real hostility towards some of the agencies and their basic missions that we really haven't seen. I mean, you could go back to the Reagan administration in 1980 and 84 and see maybe some of that same kind of thinking. Let's put somebody in charge who doesn't really believe in most of the things that the agency has typically done. We're already getting into some pretty weird areas here. Yesterday's sub-stories was that the Trump transition team wanted to know who in the EPA staff had worked. They wanted the names of people who'd worked on climate change stuff, who'd gone to climate change conferences. They wanted emails connected to all that. And the department just said, well, we're not going to do that. I'm really sorry because, first of all, that looks an awful lot like a witch hunt. And second of all, it sort of just violates aspects of the professional canon that you're going to come in here and demand a list of names of people who have behaved under orders responsibly with regard to a set of policies. No, we're not going to do it.
Yeah. And just very quickly, Suzanne, this idea that anything is going to substantively change in these departments that have been run across different presidencies as bureaucracies, I think it misunderstands a bit of just how powerful the Washington bureaucratic machine is. You're not going to change it overnight because you put somebody at the top who doesn't believe in it.
Right. There are these cultures within the agencies, and maybe that's what Trump is trying to do by picking some of these people who are kind of anti-establishment, that he's hoping they'll shake up the bureaucracy.
Now, as a counterpoint to all this, Daniela, Linda McMahon, since last week's show, gets picked to head the Small Business Administration. She's being widely hailed, including by Democrats, as someone who seems like a pretty sensible pick, all things considered.
Yeah, it was interesting. Both Chris Murphy and Senator Blumenthal put out statements after her nomination, really praising her. And, when you think back to that race, especially with Blumenthal, how nasty it was and how deeply personal it was and how, Senator Blumenthal seemed to, really hate everything she stood for, with wrestling and everything else. I mean, the tone was very different and really interesting.
Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about.
Can I just say one quick thing?
Please. Yeah.
I think the good news is that Linda McMahon is one of the most supremely qualified Trump picks so far. I think the bad news is that Linda McMahon is one of the most supremely qualified Trump picks so far.
That's Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show. Danielle Altamari from the Hartford Courant. Suzanne Bates is here from the Yankee Institute. One of her favorite things to talk about in the world is pension negotiations and spending caps. We're going to do that when we come back right after this break in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're looking at the week's news with Daniela Altamari from the Hartford Courant, Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute, and Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show. So, Colin, what's on your show this afternoon? It's actually pretty linked to what we're talking about today.
Yeah, which is unusual, right?
Yeah.
I'm usually completely – we're talking about the Electoral College today and how it actually works and what happens and why people get interested in it, once every 16 years.
And you're going to be talking, amongst others, to Jim Himes, who has taken to Twitter and other places saying that, maybe the electors should think twice about electing Donald Trump.
Yeah, we'll have lots and lots of other guests, not just Jim Himes. I don't want to drive any listeners away.
Now, come on. Jim Himes will be very interesting on this point. So amongst the things that happened this week, Governor Dan Malloy and state employee unions announced an agreement Friday to restructure pension payments in order to avoid continuing fiscal problems in the future. The deal was reached after months of behind-the-scenes talks regarding the future calculations. The state was facing potentially huge future pension payments and tried to, quote, help avoid the fiscal cliff the state would otherwise face. Here's a little bit of audio from Malloy in a press conference on Friday.
We'll avoid that fiscal cliff, and we'll put the state on a more sustainable course that the taxpayers, and quite frankly, very largely the business community demands. It's predictable at this point. Among the other key provisions of this agreement, it adopts a more conservative estimate for future performance of our state investments, thereby minimizing the impact of downturns in the stock market. Let me put this in perspective. During the time that we've been in office together, those of us who have served for the last 6 years, we've actually lowered our expectation with respect to return on investment by 14%.
That was clearly taken with a hidden microphone somewhere. Dan Malloy talking about this deal. What do you see in this pension deal with the state employees, Suzanne?
I think there are some things to applaud, which is something I don't always say about things Governor Malloy does. I mean, I think changing the discount rate, which is your expected rate of return over, you know, from 8% down to 6.9% is good. I think it should have been lower, but I think that's a good first step. I don't like the idea of asking our children and grandchildren probably to be paying liabilities that we have accrued, you know, in our lifetime. But what choice? Did he have another choice? I don't know. I would say, though, that this, you know, I don't think we need to say, oh, we're done. Pension reform is done. It's not done. You know, it's still a huge and growing portion of our budget. It's still a huge problem. There's so much more that needs to be done. I don't want them to do a victory lap and say, hooray, we've done it.
But isn't that part of the issue that's happened before when these negotiations, Danielle, have taken place, that there's a sense, okay, well, we've done that again. Well, here's something else we've done. We have kicked the ball again down the field quite a bit, and we haven't fully solved the problem.
Yeah, but, you know, there's really no way to fully solve the problem without kicking it to some degree down the road because it's such a huge, 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 huge problem.
What are Republicans saying about this? Obviously, they're not entirely happy. There's a slightly different makeup of the Senate coming in. Maybe there's going to be a little bit different sort of thought process about how budgets are created over the course of the next couple of years at the state capitol. What's the reaction from Republicans now?
It's been largely, you know, this is window dressing. You know, this is nice, but it's really not, you know, not at all what we need. We need to go much, much further. It's been sort of their take.
And is there support from Democrats to try to go much further? Are there any Democrats saying this is a problem that needs to be solved and we need to address this in a new way that's more than just this negotiation now?
I don't know. I mean, you know, clearly there are many people saying this needs to be addressed. You know, whether they have the political will, you know, the gumption to do it, that we'll see in the next few months.
Pension reform? This isn't pension reform. Stop calling it pension reform. Even Suzanne, I feel like I'm more Republican than Suzanne today. Don't call it pension reform.
Give me a minute.
This is just accounting.
She's just warming up.
This is like Leo Bloom and the Producers or something. I mean, this doesn't have anything to do with pension reform. You know, and it's probably not a cliff. It's an iceberg. They were going to hit an iceberg. So, yeah, you had to do something. You had to steer the ship around the iceberg. So that's what they did. Or they pretended the iceberg was further away than it really is. But it's not, you know, I mean, really, if your idea, I actually loved in the Malloy thing that one of the big accomplishments was to lower expectations, you know, which I think you could probably say about a lot of things. But this isn't pension reform. Pension reform is like, you know, Rhode Island or there are places that have done, but you know, you start with saying, you know, we're probably going to have to contribute more to your pension reform than 0 or 2%. To your pension. I'm sorry. I see I'm all upset now.
I was trying to start with a positive. You know, there are some positives here.
You don't have to about this.
Okay. He's gotten you all fired up now. Now that you've gotten the positives out of the way.
One other thing, too. Yeah. I think Fasano and Claritas are right. That there should be up or down votes on all this crap. Yes. You know, make them vote on it in the legislature. Make them run on it. You know, because it's not pension reform and it's not really a structural way of addressing the problem. It's a way of spreading the problem out in a different scatter pattern.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are so many things that need to be done. We have a quarter of state employees who pay zero into the pension fund. The rest pay 2%. That is unbelievably low compared to the national averages. We have the highest pension out payments in the country, according to census. You know, we have huge problems in our pension system. It's very difficult to address them because we collectively bargain for our pensions. All of our neighbors set their pensions in statute. I would say that's number one. That's the first change you need to make. I know we can't touch that agreement till 2022, but let's set this in statute so that we can actually make good reforms. Now, I would say, too, we often talk about the state employees' pension fund. We don't talk a lot about the teachers' pension fund, which is also, I mean, so we put $2 billion into it in 2008. And at that point, it was about 70% funded because we borrowed money and put it into the pension fund. Now it's down to 57% funded. I mean, we've been paying our full payments every year, and it's still getting worse. So that's something. Teacher pensions are set in statute. That's something that lawmakers could do today. And you asked, Daniela, is there hunger for reform among Democrats? Yes. I have talked to many moderate Democrats who would like to see pension reform. Now, they're afraid to take on the unions and their leadership, quite frankly, which I think is understandable. But I think there is hunger for reform, and it's bipartisan. But who has the guts to bring it up and carry the ball forward?
Yeah, does the hunger for reform show up at the state capitol in January, February?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question. And, Susanna's right. I mean, the leaders are going to have to set the tone, and they're going to have to be the ones that are going to have to show the leadership out there, and we'll see.
That's what I'm talking about. Don't make me be the Republican. I'm going to get all these emails from that guy David Samuels calling me a whore now. That's like the rest of my morning because Suzanne was too nice the first time around. Don't be nice.
Look, there's a lot more to talk about, but we have to take a break now on the program. And we're going to take this break in order to have you talk to some people who care deeply about WMPR and all the programming that we have here on the station. I'd like you to think about contributing during this December membership drive to WMPR in support of The Wheelhouse, The Colin McEnroe Show, Where We Live, The Faith Middleton Fushmoos, all the other great shows that we provide to you here, as well as NPR and BBC News. We do this for you because we know you care about the news. Now help support it. Here's some folks to tell you how you can do it. We'll be back in a couple minutes in The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news today with Daniela Altomare, State House reporter from the Hartford Courant, Suzanne Bates, policy director at the Yankee Institute, and our own Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Let's get through some more news we haven't talked about yet. Governor Daniel Malloy has urged President-elect Donald Trump not to meddle in complex negotiations ongoing over the F-35 fighter jet program, just powered by engines made by Pratt & Whitney in Connecticut. Trump tweeted that the cost of the program is, in his words, out of control. He said he'll save billions of dollars in military purchases when he assumes power. Malloy says he thinks someone should take away the president-elect's phone.
There are very sensitive negotiations going on between the Defense Department and Lockheed, and those need to play themselves out. Having said that, just this last week, the first F-35 delivered to a foreign nation was delivered. This is a successful program. It is, by all accounts, an unbelievable jet powered by the best engines in the world.
Okay, so Dan Malloy says, stay out of it, Donald Trump. Donald Trump sort of all over the place when it comes to whether or not he wants to advantage American manufacturing or not. What do you see in this F-35, dust-up between Trump and UTC?
Yeah, so first of all, I'm not going to sit here and masquerade as an expert in weapon systems. I'm not even sure I got all the way through Top Gun the one time I tried to watch it. So, but I do think, first of all, though, as a process, this is a horrible way to go about things. We already know that, but this is welcome to the new America. You wake up in the morning, and whatever your job is, there's possibly a tweet waiting that can really materially affect your job, the price of your stock. You know, I think Lockheed Martin took this huge hit, and it's crazy. It's just a completely crazy way to do things. Having said that, I welcome a conversation about stuff like the F-35. I don't know a heck of a lot about it. It's certainly not the case that Malloy is speaking the truth when he says, by all accounts, it's a great jet. There are a whole bunch of different critiques of the F-35, which is, let's be clear, it's a single-seat dogfight-type jet. Its big accomplishment is stealth technology, right? There are some people who know a lot about jets who will tell you that it doesn't maneuver as well as an F-16, it's the case for it, as I understand it, is that you get to shoot somebody down before they know you're there because of the stealth. So I don't know. I'm not saying that I know a lot about this, but these weapon systems are really, really expensive. And even if we sell them to other governments, they cost us a lot of money. We have a gigantic defense budget. If he wants to talk about that in some kind of constructive way and put a whole bunch of stuff on the table. I mean, also, the F-35 ship has sailed. I guess it's not a ship, it's a plane. But okay, the plane has flown.
Flown.
I mean, you are not going to dismantle the F-35 system retroactively, but if he wants to have a conversation about these weapon systems, and he's really serious about saving money, it might be one of those rare instances in which this toddler who's running through Pottery Barn right now yanking stuff off the shelves gets one right.
I want to turn to another one of Suzanne's favorite topics, the spending cap. The final spending cap commission meeting, I suppose, happened this week. You're a member of this commission?
I was a member of the spending cap commission. I think our work is done, although at the end of the day, we voted on a definition and it failed. So
you voted on a definition of the spending cap
right,
itself.
Well, of general fund expenditures, right? We had three definitions. We had to define income, inflation, and then what general fund expenditures were. And we came up with definitions of income and inflation. Fascinating, I know. But the definition, basically, you know, there were sort of two factions on the commission. One wanted to Swiss cheese the spending cap. The other side did not want to Swiss cheese the spending cap and allow more spending to get around the cap.
I am not familiar with that particular verb.
I like Swiss, it.
To Swiss cheese something.
But I like it.
How does one Swiss cheese?
You poke a lot of holes in it, right? We have this spending cap to go, you know, sort of rewind a little bit here, right? In 1991, when they came up with the income tax, there was this grand bargain. We're going to cap spending so that we're not constantly dialing up your taxes. Well, look, we had a spending cap voted on by 82% of the voters, approved by 82% of the voters in 1992. And since then, they have never fully enacted the spending cap. So it's been 24 years. I think people should be frustrated with that. 24 years the legislature was supposed to define this thing and have never done that. So this commission was supposed to come up with some definitions so that we could finally define the cap and fully implement it and hopefully stop this constant dialing up of income taxes, which is exactly what has happened. But unfortunately, we weren't able to come up with a final definition. And so there's some talk about maybe the commission keeps going, but at this point it looks like it's over and it will be in the legislature's hands to try to define these terms.
In the legislature's hands to define the terms? Are they going to take this on, the Swiss cheesing?
Well, I don't know. I think the list of things they may not take on is growing by the minute. I mean, these are hard things. These are complicated things, so...
Yeah, and it's something that clearly they haven't wanted to take on, as Suzanne says, for mm-hmm. for quite some time, for decades, Colin.
Pass. Eyes glaze over.
He doesn't like talking. You didn't even seem that excited talking about the spending cap.
No, she did.
I am.
She's got some costs.
I understand, too, that, you know, it's you know, government minutiae, but I think it's important. I think it's important that we honor voters' intent. You know, I mean, I just think that's really disrespectful to say what you did in 1992. It's in our state constitution.
I will say this doesn't matter. First of all, I completely agree with that. Either really do it or stop saying that it exists. Like, we've been living, I think you correctly say, in this middle ground. The difference between you and me is that I don't have hours of my life that I'll never get back trying to do something about this.
Okay, so here's something interesting.
Not to depress you.
You should have come. It was fascinating.
This gets into a personal health story that actually has a lot to do with how we're going to make laws coming up in this brand new Senate at the state capitol. So Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney from New Haven is to undergo a kidney transplant from a live donor next week. This ends a four-month search for a kidney, and we certainly wish Senator Looney very well. We're glad that he has this transplant availability. It adds another little element of uncertainty to this evenly divided Connecticut Senate. So, Daniel, let's talk about this. So Marty Looney is going to have a kidney transplant. There's normally a recovery time. This sort of sounds like one of those stories where a star quarterback sprains his ACL, is told by doctors that you'll be out at least four months. There's no way you're coming back before the end of the season. And then he miraculously appears on the field a couple weeks later because his team needs him so badly. Is that what's going on here?
Well, we've been told that he will be back before the start of the session in early January. Hopefully that's the case. But, you know, just for his own, you know, personal health, and hopefully things go well for him. But, you know, there are these negotiations ongoing about this very sort of delicate dance that Senate, as you noted, is tied 18-18. It's the first time since the 1890s, I believe, that this has happened. We're sort of in new territory. We don't really know what the leadership of the chamber is going to look like. And Senator Looney is obviously, you know, a key piece of that, as is his Republican counterpart, Senator Len Fasano. discussions are going on. We have not been told if they've reached any sort of agreement, and now Senator Looney is going to be out of the mix for a bit. So it really will be fascinating. You know, we talk about the changes in Washington, but there are going to be big changes coming in Hartford, you know, over the next 6 months or so.
And how much do you think, Colin, we actually feel those changes? I mean, does this split in the Senate actually substantively change, say, what we'll be talking about in a couple months in terms of how policy is being made at the state capitol?
Oh, I think so. First of all, I object to your comparison of the state Senate to the NFL, because the NFL has much stricter rules about when they'll let somebody back on the field. I mean, we saw this with Andy Maynard. We're seeing it with Marty Looney. Really, just, you know, take your shot and get out there. I think we're going to – I think it, for all the reasons Daniela just said, it materially affects – I mean, just to go back to the pension thing we're talking about. Well, one reason to have an up or down vote is to get everybody on the record. But if it's 18-18 and you've got chronic defectors from the Democratic side, like Joan Hartley and Paul Doyle, you might win some of those votes. So, you know, it's not just a matter of getting people on record. There's some things that are not going to carry. The Republicans, Fasano, I would assume, will push for a lot of votes that he might not have cared about in the past because he can win some, he can make people go on the record. Yeah, I think it's going to be – I mean, it's not going to be any more fun or exciting to cover for Daniela. But it'll be different.
I disagree. I think it's going to be fascinating. I don't know. I think,
you think
political
the spending
watchers.
Cap is interesting.
I know.
You
I
walk
get
right
excited
into
about
that.
These kinds of things. But
you need to get
I think
Netflix
it's,
or something.
It's going to be a very interesting year. Look, we're going into a session with a huge budget hole. Right? We have to set a 2-year budget. We have what, $1.7 billion, depending on who you talk to, hole in the first year budget. You know, another big hole in the second year. They're going to have to come up with a budget in a Senate chamber that is divided, yes, on paper, but you've got two fiscal conservatives in the Democratic caucus. And I think, you know, you've got people in the House side trying to talk about new taxes, the Governor Malloy. How do you get new taxes through that Senate chamber? I don't know how you do it. How are they going to come up with a budget by the end of the session? It's going to be so interesting. I mean, I think they may end up in court over the rules. I think there's all kinds of things. And I think it's going to be
okay. I'll take an Ativan
super
so I don't
exciting.
Get overexcited.
I'll say, how are they going to come up with a budget is kind of a recurring theme, though. It doesn't just happen in this particular scenario.
Right. But in 2015, the last time they had to do this, they had enough votes that they could really shove it through. They twisted arms. Mm. They you know, gave away the farm, you know, in order to get votes. They're not going to be able to do that this year.
I think it could. I mean, Daniela knows better than I do. But, you know, first of all, you never, ever have a session that's not completely kneecapped by petty rivalries. Now, often the rivalries are between the president pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House.
That's right.
You know, they're both Democrats. They're fighting like cats and dogs. They won't let each other's bills out on the floor on the last night. We might actually go back to just general, you know, good old-fashioned partisan divisiveness, which would be really fun.
and between the branches, you know, certainly the executive branch, the governor's office, and the legislative branch haven't exactly been super chummy over the past few years.
For the last couple minutes of the show, I just want to mark something that I know a lot of you are thinking about today. 4 years and about 30 minutes ago, a gunman walked into the Sandy Hook School and took the lives of 20 children and 6 educators. And it's something that we live with here in Connecticut, all of us every day. But, of course, the people who were involved, they live with even more so. When I was recently on the stage with former Education Secretary Arne Duncan at the Bushnell, and they asked him about his best and worst days being in that job, he said by far the worst day was the day he found out about the Sandy Hook shooting. So much has, of course, transpired over the course of the last 4 years, Colin. And to a lot of people who have been looking for more substantive changes surrounding gun laws, maybe not that much has happened. What are you thinking about on this day 4 years later?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm thinking that next year will be a 5-year anniversary and there'll be a temptation to say, well, what have we done? I think we kind of know the answer. We wouldn't have done very much about this at all. You know, in a nation that is openly hungry for or at least amenable to expanded and more rigorous background checks, you can't even get that thing through. But the thing that I've been thinking a lot about is fake news because tragically, compounding the tragedy of Sandy Hook, it was really, you know, I mean, not that fake news hasn't been around for a long time, but you could sort of say it was one of the big spikes for it. There emerged this whole group of people that has gotten larger rather than smaller, considerably larger, as far as I can tell, rather than smaller, that actually don't believe it happened. You know, I mean, this is just absurd and offensive to us. We know people like Jimmy Green, you know, mm-hmm. people we've known for a long time whose lives were shattered by this. The notion that it didn't happen is just insane. But it's there, you know, and it's, you know, it's been expounded by Alex Jones, who, as you pointed out last week, has, you know, received some thank yous from the president-elect. I'm horrified by this. And I'm troubled by it, and it's a symptom of a much bigger problem that it, as a nation we can't even agree that something like this happened.
Suzanne?
Yeah, I think, you know, sending your kids to school every day, that day is just burned in your memory. It's so frightening as a parent to think about it. It was horrifying. And, you know, I think a lot of the things that we'd hoped we'd have conversations about, I just think it's a shame that it's very difficult right now for us to have conversations about mental health, about, you know, I mean, a lot of the gun laws that were proposed are not laws that would have changed that day. So I think, you know, there's it's been very difficult to have conversations about it. And I think ultimately, I think we need to take the day and remember and mourn, you know, and hug your kids and just be grateful.
We have a call from Jim in Newtown we won't be able to get to. He echoes Colin saying horrified that Donald Trump won't disavow Alex Jones. Daniela, some thoughts from you very quickly.
Well, I just, you know, Colin mentioned that nothing's been done. But, you know, things have been done. Certainly in here in the state, things have been done. Other states, you know, gun control issues were on the ballot and they won in several states. We also had a mental health bill that was just signed into law yesterday by Governor Obama. I'm sorry, President Obama.
By President Obama, yeah. It's something that Chris Murphy and others worked very hard on. I just want to say, as a closing thought, our hearts go out to all of those families involved and everyone who does hug their kids on the way out the door and thinks about this day. Thanks very much for joining us in the Wheelhouse. Now, here's some folks to tell you how you can support all the things you hear on WNPR.